Okay, so kind of picking where we left off, and again, I won't go into all this detail in my nitty-gritty example, but just want to give you a very, very rough snapshot of just how far this has come and where it's going, because this whole concept of, for instance, utilizing this sort of membrane system as a molecular transport vehicle, and over here we have this kind of, I don't know what you call it, nanobiological sort of mechanical representation of a living system and viewing different complexity layers. This is what's being done. I mean, this is like we're here. This is the whole concept. So the idea is that we're looking at self-organizing, self-assembly membrane structures and manifolds as a kind of a system framework from which these kind of nanobiological and nanotechnology realms are actually being extrapolated from. And again, it's a very much a hierarchical system approach to how this is being managed as an industry, as an infrastructure, as it were. And the whole idea is to keep increasing process precision. In other words, what I mean by that is, it's one thing to say, take a computer chip. And computer chips are manufactured in the following way. Basically, you grow a rod of silicon called a rutile. You slice it up, make these big wafers, and then it goes through this extremely complicated process where you laminate onto it a photosensitive chemical. You photographically sort of project an image of the circuit that you're trying to etch. And you literally have to go through a chemical mill process and sort of etch away the materials you don't want there. And you sputter on more material, then you run through another etch, and you repeat that pattern many times over again. And the scale of precision with which that can be done is sort of being pushed to its ultimate edge. But the whole point is, when you get down to the molecular level, it's very messy. I mean, if you took the highest scale integration chip that exists today and put it under a microscope and had a look at the actual features, it's pretty bumpy. It's all edgy and full of bumps and contortions. At this scale, at this level of molecular precision, those bumps and sort of messiness, as you want to call it, wouldn't exist there at all. What I'm trying to get at is, you go a couple, three orders of magnitude further into a scale of complexity and hierarchical system development. And furthermore, you're not doing a top-down manufacturing, you're doing a bottom-up assembly at the molecular level. So the whole infrastructure is pointing towards this idea that says, can we take this kind of mechanism and convert it into the products that we're actually creating for today's market? The answer is yes. But what I'd kind of like to lean towards, and this is what I was sort of nibbling at in the first half, that we're kind of looking at this, what I call the primary elements of the emergent operational ecology. And by the way, once again, this background, that's actually a circuit for a living system. That's actually a snapshot right off the screen from yet another in silico biology system, and further later if you wish. But the whole point is that we have this combination of resources, like elements, if you will. And so the basic four primary elements are computers, and by computers, I don't just mean a gray box with a CPU. I mean computers of all different types, both distributed and singular. Networks to sort of tie them all together into this fabric, as it's called. And at the other end of the spectrum, we have the physical realm of the biotech and nanotech domains that sort of cross into each other. And again, the point I'm trying to make here is that the stuff that the biotech industry physically produces, the proteomics, the lipids, and all the other components from which living things are made, are now being harvested as molecular assembly systems to drive the nanotech industry. And if you start talking about things like self-assembling thin films, membranes, three-dimensional structures like the scaffolds I referred to earlier, these are systems that are grown. And in fact, I just finished writing up a report for a company called Ardessa. It's a $100 million MEMS company. And in one of my statements, I suggested to them, I said, the chips of the future aren't going to be machined. They're going to be grown, quite literally. And in fact, they're going to be complex molecular systems, where the software that makes that system possible is the proteomic instruction set that drives the assemblage. And believe it or not, I just came from a conference as of yesterday. In fact, this is the book from the conference right here, where that was exactly what was being demonstrated. So if we want to step back a bit further, just to kind of take a second view of this, I call this the 21st century architecture. Because if you go back in time, you look at the last great industrial revolution, maybe the steam age, for instance, or when the first sort of metascale highway systems were brought to life, or when, you know, jet aircraft were first introduced, and that kind of changed the economy of the day, although that's kind of in question right now. Sorry for the timing of that. But anyways, I'm just trying to come up with certain reference points. You could sort of pick apart the subcomponents of that hierarchy. So what I'm trying to suggest is we have a new kind of architecture evolving. And again, the primary components are the computers, the networks, the nanotech, and the biotech that sort of interrelate with each other. And again, the transport mechanism that facilitates this is the neurons. The network is like a neurological system. The bits are the kind of instruction sets that are the process modalities that the computers facilitate. the biotech forms the genetic makeup of what we're about to become in other living things as well. And of course, nanotech is the manipulation of atoms and molecules. And I gave the example in the first half about how 25 years ago we turned lead into gold. And I suggest to you that before too long, you'll be turning all kinds of materials and other materials to suit the fabrication of interest. Because if we can cross the boundary point of superconductivity as a manufacturable mechanism, I think is quite doable, you're going to see that entire realm come to pass. But where this is really going, and this is the more important part in my personal opinion, is this contextual cognition in the emergent operational ecology. And what this really means is we have a kind of a new type of hyperdimensional existence navigation. What do I mean by this? You and I can have a chat in this room, discuss ideas, bounce things around, compare ideas, etc. We can go on the internet and see other people's ideas as well. We can watch television or listen to radio and get sort of a monodirectional broadcast of something that might affect our interest in our belief system. We might engage in other forms of hybrid media where you have the web and, say, a radio broadcast are tied together. But this is all still kind of a really small little layer of, it's like a very small orifice to which an incredibly huge and ever-expanding realm of complexity is trying to be extruded through in terms of this incredibly complex and ever-increasing complexity of knowledge ontology. So in a sense, we're being sort of drawn towards, not because it's fun or interesting, but because it's required, again, as I said in the first half, relying upon artificial life form-like components, the next generation of intelligent agents, the next generation of what I call synthetic sentience that guides us through this hyperdimensional realm where it's no longer functional just to type something into a search engine so you find this whenever you get around to it, or I need to see an overview of maybe 10 different arenas of knowledge simultaneously because of a decision coming up, which I have to render within a handful of minutes. We're going to have to sort of readapt to a new kind of multidimensional realm that transcends the sort of monodimensional realm that we're in right now, and it has been the consistent theme for most of our history that we know of. This is the first time we had to be challenged in this way. And as I was saying earlier, this is kind of like an evolutionary event horizon, where we're going to have to allow ourselves to be symbiotically trusting, if you will, of those other life forms, artificial or not, that guide us through this hyperdimensional realm. And as I said, you can look at the biotech industry as a good example. That's all right.
Guide us through the other organs, the life forms guide us through?
Well, yeah.
I
mentioned in the first half, I'm sorry. I'll recap a little bit. Okay, sorry. What I discussed earlier was this. Are you familiar with genetic programming? The concept. Okay, so the concept says, and I mean, I just came from the Gecko conference because I've been a member for years. Gecko being genetic and evolutionary computing. The concept goes as follows. That you have a shift occurring as we speak, not as a theory or as an academic grant program, but the industry drives the requirement for it. There's no other option available. And it goes as follows. You have to create a realm, a sort of a physiological model, to extract or discover new forms of knowledge that simply could not be contrived through normal human means. I mean, we're already there. And if you go into the financial services industry, if you go into the biotech world, if you go into a whole collection of entities out there who specialize in meta-scale systems modeling, risk analysis, that kind of thing, all they do is this. There are no humans typing code and waiting for answers to come out the other end. At the exact same time that's happening, you also have things like the artificial brain program, which has been going on in Japan for 3.5 years now. And what's happening there is, in fact, I have an example in this, but and I can't go into too much detail, it'll take you long, but to kind of summarize, if you use a reconfigurable computing platform using what are called FPGAs, these are programmable gateways, these are devices that are soft. They don't have the code burned into them like you do in a traditional computer chip. They're like memory in a way, they're completely soft. They're like gate arrays that are constantly being reconfigured. That's why it's called reconfigurable logic. That's particularly interesting because as a hardware platform, it allows one to create physiological, what I call biological metaphors and continue that simply wouldn't function on an ordinary computer. Why is that relevant? Because in extremely complex knowledge ontology management, in things like in silico biology where you have to model an entire cell all at the same time, I showed a slide this in the first half, I'm sorry I missed it really. The point is that the mechanisms that make that possible can only be solved by using these sort of biological processes run on boxes full of silicon, if you will. But the whole point is that we're now becoming ever more reliant on utilizing artificial life-like processes to guide us through these extremely complex knowledge ontologies. So the next layer up from this is, and this is already being done. In fact, when I was chief scientist of evolutionary networks, that's what we were doing. We were sort of creating a web knowledge processing engine designed to, in a sense, not rely upon you typing in a keyword and then waiting for a while for a search engine to do something interesting. It was quite the opposite. In fact, I wrote a paper, something called an affinity engine, where you define a sort of a genre of knowledge, a sort of an epicenter of knowledge, and through natural semantic language processing, over time, the system would evolve an understanding, a sentient awareness, if you might say, of the value of the knowledge that it had encountered, and it would continue to evolve and become ever more robust. It would become like an extension of yourself. And if we're living in an age where it's not just an interesting thing to do, but it becomes a requirement to function in this ever more high acceleration, high complexity, knowledge-centric kind of operational ecology we're living in, we'll have to rely on the fact that there'll be artificial life forms. And the term artificial life form is a very specific term. I mean, I spoke at the ALSS conference. If you do a web search in ALIFE, you'll get lots of response. If you want to see an example, by the way, I strongly suggest you should visit the Santa Fe Institute. It's probably the largest institute in this country, at least, that has hundreds of people from the mathematics and science and computer science and biology world, and all sort of mixed together to create these artificial life-like engines, the purpose of which is to evolve strategies to solve problems or to organize knowledge that humans cannot do. And when I gave my talk at the Computational Anthropology Conference in 97, which I mentioned in the first half, this was the very epicenter of what was being discussed then, not just because it was a better way to design drugs or something, but because mission-critical decisions, which are being compressed into ever shorter timescales, the only way to approach those decisions from a complexity hierarchical analysis perspective was to use nothing other than these evolutionary computing models to solve those kinds of scenario problems. So we're sort of here. It may not be quite current at the consumer level yet, but it is in a way because a lot of the products that you buy, a lot of the things that you sort of take for granted in your daily life, these processes are what enables them. So it's the next logical step, and we're sort of almost there at this moment. That says that when I wake up in the morning and have my cup of tea or whatever, I'm about to connect into the process I'm working with, it won't be me that has found the next bit of knowledge necessary or has done some hierarchical organization. It will be my artificial life forms and a collection of them, as a matter of fact, which are commoditized as a resource base that I now have to trust as my entry point into this other knowledge domain. That's the threshold right at this moment in time. And it'll get much more so in the near future. So that's what I was trying to hopefully portray. So the thing that I was hoping to get into the next scale is that it's going to answer your question away. Then we have a series of cultural imperatives. That is this whole idea of being able to trust something that we can't touch or see. That is this, we have, again, the first half went into some discussion about these huge, megalithic, top-down, centralized, bureaucratic mechanisms that are the founding sort of layer for all of our manufacturing systems and so on. Well, we're kind of wandering into a world where this is going to be challenged and dissipated to a certain extent. And so, again, just as I was saying, the acknowledgement that we're at a point in time where knowledge complexity, scale and velocity is exceeding human capacity for mission-critical decisions, we're there in many different examples. However, how ubiquitous this recognition becomes, and the fact that many people who have talked about the so-called global brain model, I mentioned it again in the first half, this whole idea that we're sort of in a global scale, interconnected, JIT-driven environment, and that your position in that environment is reliant more upon this than on the humans that you're working with. There's lots of examples of this. It may not be publicly broadcast as policy, but the whole idea is that people are sort of having to reorient their cultural orientation to understand it, allow this to be part of their life. And so I just offer again, as I said in the first half, that the internet is the cultural and functional equivalent of Gutenberg's press combined with the Library of Alexandria, manifest in a real-time global environment. And as a cultural, anthropological threshold marker point, as I was saying earlier, you think of the Library of Alexandria full of scrolls that had been sitting there for centuries and it was the world's knowledge base. You look at Gutenberg's press that enabled the publishing of books for the first time so the average person could actually hold a book and like be exposed to new ideas and new thoughts, if you will. And it took a handful of years to sort of get this migration over the edge of Europe where the Renaissance began. You compress all that into a singularity, multiplied by a trillion or more. That's what the internet looks like at this moment in time, as a cultural driver. So the cultural imperatives that sort of come out of all this is you have the following thing. You have embedded intelligences, you have integrated lifestyle management, again, like I was saying in the first half, where you have all of your financial information, your medical information, the sort of informatics of your existence, all sort of tied together in this unified environment. Believe me, things are moving very close in that direction. And you have this sort of ubiquitous interactive process environment where everything does sort of affect everything else. But what does this really do? The major things that people are most focused on, rightly so, is the sort of trichotomy between privacy, which everyone would like to protect if possible, security, but at the same time, verification that it's you. In other words, you've heard a lot about this stuff about identity theft and so on. That's the beginning edge of a much larger Pandora's box, believe me. And I've given a number of lectures on this where, so, I mean, there was a film that came out with Arnold Schwarzenegger called Total Recall, I think it was. Okay, so that was a pretty good, it was like Hollywood snapshot of this. And there is going to come a point in time where the car you're driving in, the building you walk, you walk through the door, the building knows it's you. You get in your car, the car knows it's you. You approach any object, and it understands who you are, what you are, and why you're there. And at any given point in time, you can transact some kind of interaction. That really is around the corner. When I was at the Ubiquitous Computing Forum, it's precisely what we're talking about. So in a way, we're getting to the edge of being able to commoditize trust. It sounds a little odd, but that's really what this amounts to. It's not so much can we put the smart chips in the gadget and can we make more chips and make everything more distributed. That's kind of rote. What you're really saying is, where is the trust boundary? Where is the sort of belief system threshold point that says, I can now acknowledge this and even trust that the invisible world out there is a friendly and sort of neutral place to be. And there's a lot of pressure to push this agenda. And again, in the first half, I was talking about the 1998 when Time Magazine had a centerfold with a smart card, also being the national ID and being your currency card and your healthcare card. So, okay, fine. That's just talking about cards. But I'm saying we're going to a next stage where you don't even need the card. Just your biometric presence is, in fact, the driver that forms a sort of seamless integration with this invisible world. Is that 3 years away? Is that 5 years away? It could probably be tomorrow, really, from a technical perspective. But again, it's the commoditization of trust as a sort of a commodity deliverable. That's where the threshold point of inception stands.
So that doesn't mean something that's intrusive or that doesn't need you to have an implant or something like that, right?
Well, it depends on who you ask. And in the world of biometrics, actually, there's a lot that's going on. Your thermal band can be detected from a distance. Your voice can be detected from a distance. There's other things that are more of a security nature, which I won't go into. But let's just say there's been a lot of push to, and in fact, this is another aspect of 9-1-1, which I didn't even get into. But one of the things I was really hoping to express today, and I may not have time really, but I'll try to get there if I can, is that there are a lot of processes already in place. They're really driven by a sense of economic urgency, by a sense of anthropological urgency, a sense that the world is in transition and that people who sort of live in my world and do this futurism projection stuff were being called upon in an ever more urgent nature to say, okay, we see this disruptive technology, we see this change in economic system, we see all these things, and you're plotting about, okay, how do we do this? What's going on? So you get called upon to kind of work out these kind of complicated roadmaps in the future, as it were. And then along the line, I mean, in my framework of reference, I had this vision that says, if the tools are used right, and that's like a big if, and like I said, the coin's in the air being flipped, but if the tools are being used even sort of right, where does this really go? Well, I'm not going to be Pollyannish and just talk about world peace. I think that's too far off in the future. But I might concept of something that I might call world stability. Is that within range? Possibly. Possibly. Because, as I said earlier, much of the terribleness of human predation that we've witnessed even in recent times is almost exclusively wrapped around this core nexus of usurpation of nation states to get access to their oil, their minerals, and all that nonsense. Okay, fine. So is there kind of a technical pathway to say, can we get around this? Possibly. But when 9-1-1 happened, what it really did was it kind of hardened, if you will, a certain set of parameters which were kind of soft and mushy and maybe could have been nudged a little further towards the world stability model. That whole timeline got pushed back many, many years, in my opinion. Whereas whatever the possibility of a stability threshold platform that looked like, it's like everything's been sort of pushed backwards. And to me, that's a real sadness because now a lot of the stuff that I've been looking at, including the biometrics, now you're going to see it pushed into action, but really because of the security concerns. We want to know that it's you and verify it and so on. So a lot of the stuff that might have been sort of debatable or up in the air in terms of policy, I think is going to get pushed as fast as you can go. And in fact, there is one person, and I can't tell you about what she's doing because I signed the NDA, but in a very rough sense, let's just say, when I was talking earlier about being able to detect presence or a state of mind, whether it's in a good state or a bad state, that sort of thing, and the experiment at Princeton and so forth, well, there's a person I know who's actually, she's a physicist, really, and she's working on a system where, at an airport, for instance, you can walk by the machine, and if the spike comes out of the noise floor, it knows that you're planning something awful. Let's just put it that way. She's actually physically doing this. I mean, this is a machine that's being worked on as we speak. So I'm not making this up. This is like a physical technology.
Is that the brain fingers printing, what they call?
No, that's a different one. That's a different one. But that's a good point as well. In a court of law, a murder case, was acquitted based on the fingerprint of experience being mapped out of the brain. That happened, 9 months ago? In other words, it's possible now to say, look, in the realm of panoramic contextual cognition, this is like a holographic rendering process. Every time I look across this room, see a face, cognize something, a series of disturbances, if you want to call them that, a series of electrochemical patterns are set up in the brain, and they leave a holographic residue of that experience. There is a way now to sort of back annotate and look for those signatures as evidence of having been exposed to the experience. In the case of this murder trial, thank you, defendant, thank you. I'm a mental block. The point was that there was a scene where there was a body and a car and a road and all these things, and they proved that the equipment could be verified by a control and said, okay, if this guy had seen the body and the car and the road in a certain way, there would be this particular kind of brain signature. They showed it wasn't there, and he was acquitted. That's how far this has gone. Oh, it was somewhere in the Midwest. I forget now. It was Nebraska or somewhere, Ohio, one of those Midwestern states. But, I mean, it was a real precedent center. It made the news, and, you know, some technical journals published it, and then it kind of faded in the background. But there's a lot of stuff going on that just, you know, it would sound like science fiction, but it's real. So, you know, I'm just trying to, like I said, offer a little snapshot. So,
years ago, they wouldn't even accept DNA.
Yeah, well, that's a good example. Exactly. So, I probably don't have time to go into this, really, and I'm sorry for that, but in plotting out this process manifold, I kind of had this thing I called the convergence syndrome triad. And just really quickly, there's three major factors, really, vectors. You have an increase of series of codependency, as I discussed earlier. You have an increase in the mesh granularity, the internodal coupling, as the nodes are being sort of more tightly squeezed together. And you have process velocity. And so if we're to plot this out, we're kind of approaching these boundary points to like this sort of threshold. And there's a variety of ways to measure this, but I'm just saying, we're as a trend, that's where we're going. So I'm going to switch up because I don't have much time left. So again, if I were to talk about the process elements of the convergence syndrome, the four main sort of influences, if it were, is process acceleration, complexity constantly increasing, time being compressed further inward, and the connectedness factor going upward. And you just plot those in a graph. And in my opinion, at least, just my own 2 cents worth, if I were to try to suggest which of the primary vectors are causing the most influence, I would suggest to you that this irreversible symbiosis threshold factor, what's really pushing this is you have this temporal compression index, that is time. Things are just getting squozed so closely together in terms of time, just like we were saying in the hallway, things that were measured in decades, now measured in years, months, weeks, etc. And the fact that they have a one-to-many distribution, a single incident now replicates throughout the entire system in a matter of hours in some cases, depending on what model you want to look at. That's never happened before in human history. I mean, let me try a different approach. Amongst the kinds of things that I often talk about with other folks is the fact that we are so internet-centric on our B2B infrastructure. Virtually every major industry now is completely and irreversibly connected to the web as the transceiving platform that they run their entire manufacturing system with, their whole supply chain, all their performance metrics, everything are dependent upon this sort of electronic infrastructure. Of all the things that would cause harm to a nation state, I mean, you can talk about microbes and anthrax, it's not even what we're talking about. A nuclear bomb would be kind of bad, I admit. But the thing that would really cause harm in a big way, if you remember, of course, in previous times, in fact, our own CIA did this kind of stuff for a while, and so did other countries. There was, if you wanted to cause real disturbance, you know, chaos is an opportunity, depending on how you look at it. Chaos as a strategic weapon, if you will. The thing to do is to devaluate the currency, cause economic disturbance, if you will, weaken the current government, put in the new government, reinvent a new currency, et cetera. Fine. But those processes take years, and they're kind of complicated and fairly messy, and actually don't work that well. By extreme contrast, what if you were able to truly sort of wipe out a majority of the electronic infrastructure, simply turn it off, or cause, you know, some truly predatory kind of virus infection. Well, yeah, well, in fact, well, that's just one example, but what I'm hoping to sort of steer towards is a sort of a larger model that says, you know, we had the example of a satellite dying last year that turned off some like 30% of the beepers in the country, something that cost billions of dollars for a few hours of off time. There are examples of some cell phone interruption on other occasions. But what if, like, everything stopped? All of your stock has changed, all of your banking systems, all of your different kinds of bureaucratic records, you know, everything you can imagine suddenly going, ugh, and it wasn't there. This would be a spectacular, it would be a disaster on a scale that nothing, I mean, forget a meteor hitting Europe, I mean, this would be the economic equivalent thereof. There are people that really strategize. This is a military option. In fact, the People's Republic of China published in the People's Daily last year as a public proclamation that they now had a new branch of the military, something like an Air Force or a Navy. Well, this is the, you know, Department of Internet Warfare, translating. We have some of that ourselves, but it's not quite so publicly broadcast. But the point is, this is like the new battlefield. This is the point of inception where you cause a one-to-many problem space boundary point with an almost instantaneous and irreversible effect. So that's the kind of process that I'm sort of suggesting is around the corner. So if I had to measure where we are at in this convergence syndrome manifold, that's the edge we're sitting at.
Information warfare, as opposed to subtle information warfare.
Maybe cataclysmic information warfare is a different way. So, to flip this all around in a different direction, does this suggest, therefore, that we're heading towards a ubiquitous synthetic sentience process manifold, where the system itself is self-correcting, self-modifying, sentient because it wants to protect itself and evolve its own strategies? Well, companies like IBM, who just made an announcement last week, this is what they're doing. They call it automatonic computing. And that's a fancy word, but it's been around for many years. Automatonic computing. And the reason they made this publication, and they broadcast this, and they now have a bunch of white papers, is because they've obviously been doing this for years. I mean, this whole background noise. Now they want to sort of project it in public so they can kind of announce it as their sort of big business move. But the point is, the whole concept of, and again, as I was reading in the first half, routing systems that are self-evolving, self-correcting. The whole internet sort of relying upon these ever more complex routing engines that have to adaptive analysis of traffic patterns and so on. So guess what? You find, you know, this stuff going into those routing engines. So the next stage says you also have the equivalent of a kind of electronic immune system, if you will. It does anticipatory analysis of different kinds of strains of potential viral-like entities and so forth, and sort of cleanses the system on its own behalf. We've crossed the line now where the biggest computing entities in the world who, in a sense, control or manufacture the majority of the stuff that makes this stuff work, this is what they're doing. They realize it's gone far beyond a bunch of guys writing code, making a little machine do something interesting. They have to rely upon the system itself as a biological entity to which we are now irreversibly connected as our economic facilitation platform. As a matter of policy, this is what they've already published. So the thing I was hoping to get to, and I probably don't have time, so I'm sorry about this, but to me, what this really suggests is we're going to get into this hyperdimensional access portal, like I was saying earlier. And by that, I mean a realm that's no longer confined to this four-dimensional framework here and is not confined to a serial sort of portal, if you will, to streams of information, but rather many different parallel threads simultaneously to which we allow these other artificial life form-like systems to sort of feed us in various increments. But it gives us a way to replicate our knowledge access and knowledge navigation potential to a much higher degree. And the thing that I'm not going to have a chance to get to, I'm sorry, is that this next layer, should we sort of survive the sort of nano-bio-infotech domain that we're actually contriving as we speak, suggests that mind-machine interface, which, like I said earlier, is actually sort of here almost, what we're really looking at is going something that is even beyond this physical stuff here. That if you want to walk down the path of consciousness itself, actually functioning in the quantum domain, this is something I very much strongly believe in, then are we in a sense enabling, just like I said about the film in the Forbidden Planet, when they turned on this system and everybody could think of the stuff they wanted and what killed them off as miles would be it. Well, the point is, if we're about to start nibbling into this domain where we can actually access this quantum realm at will, that by focus of mental intentionality. We can sort of transcend the limitations of time and space and empathically connect and all that sort of thing. Well, this could be very useful. I mean, there's people right now who are actually looking at empathic influencing for health. I mean, Qigong has been around for, you know, 3,500 years. I mean, after all, I went to the 4th International Qigong Conference. Thanks to Henry, by the way. But, I mean, this concept's been around for many, many, many years. Over the Noetic Sciences Institute, I mean, Elizabeth Targ and her colleagues have been working for several years. I met somebody who worked at NASA in 82 on experiments involving, guess what, empathic influencing on physiological phenomena. From a distance of 5 miles, they were able to change, you know, somebody's heartbeat and so forth. So, I mean, this is pretty well documented stuff. So, I mean, are we kind of crossing a line that says we have yet another Pandora's box of tools to work with, which dwarf even what the nanotech, infotech, biotech realm represents? Yes. Are we ever remotely close to having the, what I call, spiritual health index or spiritual maturity to actually use this effectively as opposed to using it as a weapon or whatever else? That could be a heavily debated argument. But what I'm suggesting to you is the following. This right here, that is an actual screen dump from the ATR program that I told you about earlier, the one in Japan, where right now they are, in a sense, evolving a 10 billion neuron artificial brain as we speak. And they plan to put it online in the year 2004. This is a Japanese government and industrial infrastructure finance project. And the theory is that because of the scale and complexity of process management and knowledge ontologies, the artificial brain is an extension of human endeavor to manage extremely complex systems. That is the stated goal. So here we are at the horizon line, sort of launching these artificial brains as we speak. In fact, there's a very well-known gentleman by the name of Hugo de Garis. He's published lots of papers on this. I've met him several times. And he, in fact, wrote a paper that I have at home, one of a few copies. And he talks about this sort of warfare of the future. And the warfare of the future suggests that it won't be so much over territory, it will be over access to process. Who has the more robust artificial brain sort of engine to work with, that kind of thing. And will there be a division? You know, people think in terms of class division as like I own land and you don't. Well, okay, that still may have some value in the future, but it might be more along the lines of I'm sort of enhanced, if you will, because I have a better degree of access. I have a smarter, intelligent entity that represents my interest in the virtual terraform, as I call it, than you. That gives me more power. It means I can brokerage and manage process in a way that you can't. That's sort of like a new competitive arena. And this is a guy who made this stuff possible, and he wrote this paper like 6 years ago. So, I mean, people are thinking along his lines, more so than what might be commonly known. But the point is, how it gets managed, we have a sort of a window to kind of look at the options. Because if I were to plot this out, this is what I see. I see that going backwards, again, this is a log scale, and we look at, you know, millennia, centuries, decades. We've plotted along over certain thresholds the ability to farm land, the ability to create written language, the ability to create roads that would connect what eventually become cities, the ability to contextually cognize fairly complex abstract ideas, wrap them in a container called faith. We cross all these kind of marker points. And yet, we go through some ups and downs, you know, world wars involving nuclear weapons, no less, and all kinds of other things that are rather awful, that suggest that we're still kind of trapped in this sort of predatory, industrial, consumption-oriented process. And yet, the tools that might enable to do something different than what we're currently doing, that acceleration base is up here. And yet we've kind of gone up these up and down moments in our what I call spiritual health index. And I would submit to you as a kind of a closing statement that if we are to cross this next evolutionary threshold, I would submit that these two lines want to be closer together, that they should be almost tracking identity. And just as a kind of I have some other slides I probably won't get into, but kind of just to go over this whole idea of a decision rendering process map. This was actually part of a paper I wrote some time ago, but it was kind of a way to express how to look at this hierarchical system. And the whole idea that you have knowledge, time, resource, and market, this was for actually a corporate presentation, the idea that to be able to approach these process boundaries, we no longer do this with humans. I mean, we do, but the humans are assisted very heavily by this. And they sort of listen to what the A life tells them and then sort of go forward. That's already being done. And where I'd like to perhaps go is just to, once again, kind of quantize this synthetic sentience threshold that says at a certain point in time, you have human decision-making capacity dropping down because of the exponential increase in knowledge. You have conditionalized knowledge volume constantly going upward. you have knowledge velocity also tracking in the same direction. And so the complexity function goes up as the inverse of the human decision rendering capacity. And we have this little box that says if your operation is in that box somewhere, you've crossed the line of relying exclusively, irreversibly, to another type of life form, if you want to call it that, driving your decision process. And there are many industries, biotech being one of them, where they're already in that box. And just as a couple of things to throw in, this is Ananova. She's a talking smart avatarist that delivers the news. Now, it's kind of comical in a way, but it kind of suggests in a very rough way that there is something around the corner that says, the face that you hear, the face that you see, the voice that you hear, the emotional bonding that you establish with some entity may or may not be human. And in fact, in a not too distant future, it'll be preferred in many cases that it's not human. In other words, right now you call up a bank or something and you get this annoying voicemail and you have to deal with all these layers of voicemail. Forget that nonsense. I was working with a company called Virtual Personalities several years ago, and we were trying to establish kind of a smart avatar banking entity so that you go online, you have this pretty face talk to you, and she would, in a human interaction kind of way, walk you through a loan process or whatever the thing is you're trying to do. Well, for a complicated reason, most of them financial as opposed to technology, it never quite got launched, although I can tell you it probably will get launched before too long. The whole point is that as we're wandering into this kind of web-centric, web-delivery, platform-based ecological system, as I keep saying, our ability to deal with human problems is becoming ever more complex and fractionalized. So is there an interest in relying upon things that sort of mimic human behavior but in fact are completely virtual? Yes. As a business model, this is exactly what's being tried. So again, we have this sort of emergent semantic entities as a culture norm. I mean, you or I might go, oh my gosh, this is terrible or it's scary or something. But next generation, this is the norm. In fact, it'll be unusual to have to wait for a... Look, humans are messy. They're imprecise. They have bad hair days or whatever the thing is. And they don't do well in complex hierarchical environments that require a lot of decision making in a small amount of time with a huge resource base to work with. It just doesn't work. It's like two lines on a chart. Does this provide a different kind of way to solve the problem? Yes, it does, because in this operational ecology, your autonomous agent framework, if it were, can look at many different pieces of information simultaneously, and it has the entire data grid there at its disposal, and it has a decision rendering capacity that humans don't really have. That's the requirement to function in this realm, not just because it's interesting. And if you look at banking, for instance, this is like their major limitation right now. They cannot deal with the interface between this ever more complex information space that they have to work with and a human that has to walk you through some ever less functioning process, you know, usually on a telephone. They know this. So to make their process work different or better, they're looking very hard at this. And I mean, you'll see it in airlines, you'll see it in all kinds of things where the human boundary point between process and the person requires a different kind of facilitation. So it becomes a kind of a peer-to-peer total existence stream, and it says, whatever existence I'm contending with here at this moment, I can sort of teleport the representation of the existence to somewhere, anywhere, ubiquitously in the system that requires it. And again, just to go over biometric recognition, as I was saying earlier about the thermal prints and the, you know, all kinds of mechanisms, the sonic analysis and so on, the idea that you walk into a building, it knows you're there, et cetera. So kind of just again, as an overview, again, we have this virtual human entity interface that's kind of like an ergonomic mechanism to allow this process to occur most smoothly. Smart sensors everywhere, digital process conversions combined with ubiquitous access portals. I can talk to, you know, this cup will become smart someday. In other words, I often start a lecture by saying my cell phone is now a toaster. That's not that far away. So the whole idea that everything is smart and kind of knows it's you and you can talk to it and talks to you, that's the kind of stuff that's around the corner. But behind the scenes, what you really have is a process programming architecture, and you have this sort of intelligent agent hierarchy that manages this process in a real-time environment.
Use that Ananova kind of a synthetic intelligence is because you walk into the block on the carpet and he says, what happened? And you say, well, no, it's Ananova.
Well, you know,
it's
the bureaucratic threshold, I guess, is interesting. But anyway, so again, this is an actual real pilot chip. This is a schematic right off the patent. It's several patents as well for distance tracking, by the way. And this is some more breakpoints of the human internet symbiosis threshold and some more worker points. Entities on demand being one of them, but in fact, the thing that, again, I keep harping on is biological metaphors and kidney, just because it's sort of already being done, and it will simply grow much faster. And the whole idea that this mechanism for enhancing the psychoeconomic interface, again, people think of the web and like blinking things on a web page and little poke at, things that you poke at. To me, that's like this unbelievably annoying sort of Rube Goldberg approach. Isn't it? No, I'm serious. Why is somebody that's so like a cult following kind of dive into the web that this is their life? I could never understand this. But what will be around the corner will be something much more ergonomically transparent to the average user. And then you'll see this kind of different realm coming fast. So, I mean, just to summarize it once again, this whole idea of like evolvable systems, virtual intelligence, et cetera, synthetic systems and strategic resource, these are the things that, if I had to break it down, are driving this next realm. And I'm not sure when I'm supposed to stop, so you just yell at me and tell me to stop. But okay, please.
One of the four, the third one is a representation that you use of a Japanese model that they're using for AI, right?
Actually, there's a whole, this is a very broad topic. And this is
my question was, as for the Japanese effort, what are some of the criteria that they're using to build their system? What are the elements?
They're not building the system, they're growing.
It's still kind of software level.
I'll say this really carefully. They're growing.
Growing.
They're not writing code and making little bot language things. They're literally growing. I don't know any better way to put this. They use, and this is not just there. I just see that one example. It's a large one to look at. But they use genetic algorithms to, in a sense, evolve the equivalent of neural net components. I don't know. This is hard, maybe. You're not sitting there typing little lines of C code. That's not what's happening at all. There are no humans.
What you're saying is
perfectly possible.
However, I'll tell you a little
paragraph. Well, I'm sorry. I mean, what I'm very kind of, what I suggest is you should really do some research if you want to. So the place to go, just start with the Science Basic, but there's a whole bunch of others, which are public, by the way. But one that's also kind of interesting is the Information Sciences, or what's called ISI. They're in Los Angeles. I've been there a few times, and you walk in the door, and you know it's mostly secure environment. You can't really just walk in there, but I've been there a couple of times. And the point is that this kind of meta-scale biological metaphors and thinking is taken extremely seriously for, again, strategic scenario simulation, battlefield simulations, different kinds of autonomous behavior for smart systems, hunter-killer vehicles, that kind of thing. I mean, it's taken it very, very far. And you've seen little pieces of this appear in Hollywood from time to time. In fact, there was that movie about this robot that kind of ran around and it said, honey, I'm home. I don't forget the name of the film. It came out a few years ago. But anyway, so the point was, it was a kind of a humorous slapstick look. Kind of a humorous slapstick look at something that's actually quite real. And it won't quite keep you out the door for a little bit. But the bits and pieces of this mechanism are being seen now by the business community. Again, not because some guy gets a grant to do his research, but because it's the only way they can run their business, to deploy this kind of stuff in their value chain, in their supply chain, in their systems process.
Charles, do you think that 100 years from now, we'll be in a better position if you could, for example, vote for a synthetic sentience to be your congressman?
I think I would vote for that today. I mean, that's not saying a lot about this. Yeah, I mean, I might vote for a lesser organism, you know, a small insect maybe, but, you know, that's just my thing. Anyway, I know we're pressed for time, so I just want to get a couple more points, because I know that some of us are really having trouble, so I apologize. But look, this is a plot from about 3 years ago. There's a guy by the name of Dave Fellow, I've known him for many years. He has a company called Evolutionary Systems, Natural Systems. This is what they were doing then, as a business, using this, with no humans. People would establish, they would define a problem space, they would define a solution space, and it would evolve the answers. When I was testifying at a Y2K symposium, which was based on risk analysis and economic theory and so on, again, this was the stuff. It wasn't a bunch of guys smoking cigars saying, well, I think if this happens. No, they were relying on this as their guide to where policy might be deployed. When they were doing meta-scale system analysis of networks, for instance, this was the choice. So I'm just really trying to, in a gentle way, suggest how much this has already been happening. Because when you, you know, go to a bank and apply for a loan, chances are something along these lines may be part of the risk analysis package that made that loan possible. When you go to do something like your next sort of, you know, drug discovery, and I use the word drug kind of loosely here, because the whole idea of, not to violate traditional medicine per se, but the whole idea of recombinant proteomics and sort of a systems level approach to physiological modification based on applied nanotechnology, as opposed to like making a chemistry as a drug, that's where things are sort of going. But to get to that point, you got to have something of this capacity to evolve the answers to those problems. And this, in fact, again, this is a screen dump from the Synthetic Brain Problem Project. This is an actual screenshot of how the neural net interconnects were evolved. And just imagine like billions of these, but you just take a tiny little snapshot of it. And I myself had worked in this kind of stuff many years ago. In the old days, we would think of a neuron as a sort of like an op-amp, as it were. In fact, there's a company called HNC, Hyd-Nielsen Corporation. I knew one of the founders quite well. And so they were trying to make this giant, you know, series of circuit boards with literally thousands of op-amps sort of interconnected to simulate a neuron. You know, the brain of a salamander would fill up half this room kind of thing. But the reality is that's kind of the old way. The way that it's being done now, of course, is you don't build anything. You grow the interconnects in a virtual environment. And so again, maybe I probably shouldn't spend much time, but the thing I wanted to point out is that these protein models, these pictures, came from, guess what, Dave Fogel's evolutionary computing platform to evolve a solution to a proteomic problem. I just kind of wanted to make that point. So this is some of the stuff that you saw in the film, and the whole idea of using a sort of a corrective chemistry, you know, slash biodevice perspective, that's kind of where things are going. Hybrid life forms, self-organizing systems, which are now being translated into being able to create self-organizing chips and things of that nature. And so to kind of bring this point home, I talk about this idea that we're at a new frontier where the organic merges with the synthetic. And in the very beginning of the talk, actually, I talked about this whole idea that the stuff that we think is natural, quote unquote, is there anything that's natural or not? Actually, it sort of doesn't matter in a way, because since we are creating the tools, it is the stuff of nature. I mean, it's no different than going backwards, like in the beginning of 2001 Space Odyssey, when you saw the eight people were dashing about, and the first one picks up a bone, and says, wow, a bone, a weapon, and he starts banging away, throws it up in the air and spins around, and all of a sudden you see the spacecraft in orbit. Well, that's kind of where we're at. We've gone from having a bone to having a much more clever set of bones to work with, but it's still part of nature. And so this screenshot, by the way, that's not a drawing, that's an actual photograph from the laboratory of Dr. Gunther Grass from the University of North Texas, and he's one of many, by the way, in this arena, who grow neurons on chips, specifically as neural prosthetics, sensory interface devices. Right here at Stanford, Gregory Kovacs, who directs the Integrated Systems Group, for 24 years now, they've been sort of working in this arena, hopefully to correct for spinal injuries, that sort of thing. You know, Christopher Reeve could get up and walk before the fate got a little bit further down the trail. But this whole idea of being able to integrate the organic and the biological to non-organic things, sort of like cybernetic modifications, I wouldn't say it's a roach exactly, but it's moving very quickly. I mean, there's several companies that have already gone commercial, Medtronic being one of them. They've actually produced several devices, one of which is kind of interesting. It's a way to counteract for epileptic seizure. Epileptic seizures occur when spikes begin to occur, and it sort of short-circuits the neurons in proximity. The theory is that if a device can measure the pre-event signature and then neutralize or cancel out by creating a spike 180 degrees out of phase, then it effectively shuts down the whole process. That's actually being done. You wear an implant to the little computer, and if something happens, it cancels out the signal. You can buy these today. In fact, there's a whole bunch of things. There's an artificial retina project going on that kind of long explanation, but the whole idea is you can actually put a device at the retina surface and will, in a sense, make up for the rods and cones that aren't there. There's a cochlear implant that's been around for years, of course. In fact, I have spent quite some time with Dr. Robert Chen several years ago at a conference in Texas. And the thing that was interesting, I was having a chat with him, and he says, you know, it's not so much difficult to get a neuron. Okay, I see the large X. The point is that, you know, I said from a surface chemistry perspective, from an integration of biological materials on microscale devices, that's all kind of been standard for years. And he said, yeah, of course, obviously. He said, it wasn't so much can we get neurons to attach to a chip and can they conduct and so on. That's kind of rote. The problem was knowing what neuron to attach where. And so, again, we're kind of wandering into this realm that says, aha, now that we are getting to a higher degree of resolution, we can measure precisely where things occur in the brain. We can volumetrically scan for and, in fact, look exactly at what happens when a certain kind of stimulus occurs. Therefore, we know where to put something if we want to change some kind of process. So you sort of mix those all together. What do you have? You have next-generation computing. You have material science that sort of reaches into the nanobiological world, and you have the ability to model these complex processes. So if you merge those all together, this is what you end up with. So once again, we're just kind of at this threshold that says, and we've got biodevices, bioengineered tissue organs, and organisms like the scaffold I was talking about earlier, this whole idea of synthetic and recombinant DNA, that becomes the new kind of genopharmacopoeia. And by the way, this thing over here, this ball, that's actually something called a dendrimer. And dendrimers are very interesting. These are pseudoproteins that can be grown in generations. In fact, they actually rate them by G factor, G4, G5, G6, and so on. Why are they relevant? Well, here's the reason. These devices, and I call them devices, but they're about 50 to 100 nanometers across, very small. You can attach other biological molecules to them, you know, lipids, proteins, enzymes, whatever the thing might be. And you can then, as a kind of a proteomic delivery mechanism, you can target a specific kind of cell and say, aha, go to that cell and only that kind of cell, and then migrate through the cell wall, go into the cytoplasm, and then chemically and sort of biophysically connect to the organelle of choice, and then dispense these compounds. This is a real thing. This exists today. In fact, there's a guy by the name of Donald Tamaglia. He has about 20 years experience in dendrimer chemistry. He just launched his company called Dendrimer Sciences about 3 months ago. In fact, I met him at this conference. So, several years ago, when I coined the word nanobiology, it was a word I sort of made up because I knew a word to come up with. I had co-authored a book called CyberLife in 94, and I coined the term in that book. In 1997, I went to the world's first biological and novel approaches in applied nanotechnology conference that was also in San Diego. And then I met Dr. Stephen Lee, who it turns out was the director of Monsanto Chemicals Nanobiological Systems Group. So I figured if Monsanto Chemical could use the term, it's probably okay to use it. But the whole point was that even going back, say, half a dozen years, the whole idea of being able to target individual cells, go into the cell, and perform some kind of a molecular scale test, this is, I wouldn't say Roche, but it was absolutely being done. In fact, the first patents were issued to a company called Honest Pharmaceutical in 1996. Honest Pharmaceutical got their funding from DARPA and through Sandia Laboratory, and of course, their world is more in the biodefense arena. But what I'm trying to get at here is we now have the capacity to grow cells on chips. We have the capacity to use molecular devices, and I use that word very carefully. I coined the term quasi-viral components because I knew no better term. But a virus, if you think about it, targets a cell because it's proteomic signature. Once it gets into the cell, it sort of opens up, shoots, literally blasts its proteomics into the cell and glomps around the ribosome, forces the ribosome to manufacture more of it. But if you back away from that and just think about the idea of a nanofoundry, a biological nanofoundry, and you have a device, a virus, which is designed to target just that kind of cell, and then utilize the nanofoundry capacity of the cell to make more of it, that's actually a very clever piece of machinery. So in a sense, we've kind of synthetically contrived our own versions of the theme, up to the point where it became a patented technology. And now, of course, you see a whole range of medical procedures, and again, not to violate traditional, you know, medical practice, but I'm just suggesting to you that the whole idea of having to back annotate some pathology and prescribe drugs and prescribe murders to counteract the first aid drugs and so on, that's fading away, and what we're looking at is something more along these lines. Okay, so this is, I have minutes left, but this is just the service of a chip from a company called Affymetrix. It's one of several who produce these kind of devices. I actually have one in my briefcase. I'll show it to you after the talk. The entire human genome can now fit onto one of these chips. So you have this kind of idea. I call it God on demand. Life forms on demand. That is the next emergent process deliverable. And by the way, process deliverable, what I'm suggesting to you, it's not the life form that you create. It's the sort of software process deliverables. The proteomics that come out the tail end, that's the last 2% of the value chain. And in fact, in the current biotech industry, that's in fact the business model. Somewhat 95% of the value chain is in virtual commodities. But physical chemistry is like the last little thread of the process. So important key features of nanotechnology, just to kind of get towards the end here, and this is why I keep telling folks that, you know, listen to these kind of talks, it's not a thing, it's not a widget, it's not tiny machines, although tiny machines are like an outcome of the process in some cases. The collection of molecular scale manufacturing systems, and as I said earlier, is the gateway to the next industrial infrastructure revolution, if you will. And just to kind of toss this in there, it's not more first law, it's more a second law. Of course, it's coming around the corner to kind of kill off the computer chip industry and force this to occur. But again, it's economies of scale and it's new value chain models. it's a systems approach to an emergent industrial infrastructure. That's what's in the life of the machines doing something here. And it's an enabling access to new markets that would not exist without nanotechnology. And I'm not even sure I use the word markets. It's new capacity that wouldn't exist for nanotechnology. And by the way, this thing, this little bumpy line down here, this is actually a nanotube, a carbon nanotube, that was, in a sense, instigated through molecular manipulation to connect to two conductor sites on the surface of a chip. And so, in fact, the concept this came from, it went through quite some detail, but for the last three and a half, four years, the process going from theory to actual manufacturing stage is sort of like we're being pushed at right now. Because the theory is you can take an existing computer chip type of a platform, view a silicon chip as a kind of a circuit board, if you will, upon which you then place, or in a sense self-assemble, these nanoscale components. You've just now bought 3 orders of magnitude on the surface of a chip, and you've just reduced the upfront cost of a foundry, also by several orders of magnitude. I'm wondering why this is too complex. This has to do with artificial enhanced complexity management. And again, this is a chart from an earlier paper, but it kind of shows the whole idea of laying belief skulls and intentions, these motivational vectors that kind of produce the output process fusion. And this is the reality of what's being done. It's not a theory. It's actually a system model from an earlier project I worked on. So the idea of knowledge harvesting as a kind of a commodity resource, and that's in fact what is happening as we speak. And the whole idea is you look at strategy, going away from defined, becoming more emergent, going from policy away from static and fixed, which is traditional, like something that's much more flexible and adaptable. And of course, the whole idea of time scale, ranging from immediate to an open-ended without internal limitations. And, well, here's the convergence outcome. This will be the last set of slides. Okay. The process now embedded within the event stream of our collective socioeconomic, anthropological, and biophysical evolution would begin first by spawning various synthetic entities. Self-organizing networks, process elements, and molecular structures then become the core organelles for a synthetic brain, which is what's happening now, which in turn become the physical components for enabling synthetic sentience rendered at the process level. Synthetic brain engines, which themselves are facilitated as sort of nano-manufactured synthetic organelle components, become interconnected to the ubiquitous processing, brokeraging, operational ecology, and that's a few years away, but we're sort of moving now. So the whole idea is such of a framework through which tangible, hard asset-based commodity-driven economic systems be supplanted by a virtual asset-based economic ecology, in which valuations measure not less, is measured less by ownership of physical things, more by access to profits. And this leads up to our collective development, deployment of complex metasystems of artificial entities and synthetic life forms, which is exactly what's happening now. And this becomes a precursor development increment as an evolutionary enabling threshold to communication with alternate intelligences, both virtual and real. They sort of get mixed together in a symbiotic environment. And the final sort of point, the one that's most controversial, of course, is that what this really does is sets up the next evolutionary development increment will be access to the quantum phone, as I said earlier. It's a byproduct of applied nanotechnology. And now the mind-machine interface, the whole idea that we sort of cross a line, becomes the enabling threshold to hybrid forms of consciousness on a mass scale, the evolution of what I might call the empathic web. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.